Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is artist Tony Angel. His paintings, drawings, and bronze and stone sculpture feature a lot of the wildlife around him. Some of his drawings can be found in the new book, Frog Day, by Marty Crump. Tony, welcome to the show.
Mark, it's a pleasure to join you.
We finally are getting to talk. The last time we had a scheduled interview, I've got to mention to the audience, you were caught in that huge, massive storm. You're in the Pacific Northwest, and you lost power and stuff.
Yeah, we had a tornado.
Jesus.
Come through.
That's not typical, is it, Tony, for there?
No, nothing is typical these days weather-wise, is it?
Yeah. No, my God. But I'm glad we're finally able to talk. Let's start out simple. I want to talk about your drawings for Frog Day.
Sure.
Now, I know that you love working with wildlife that you see, that you know in your area. But a lot of these frogs are not from around here. There's the horned marsupial frog, the narrow-mouthed frog from Borneo. Did you work from photographs, or what did you work out? How did you work?
Well, I do know the frog form in general, but
you're absolutely
right. They are very, very diverse. You know, you got 7,600 species. They've had millions of years of evolution. They've taken different paths. So clearly, there are unique characteristics that I had to determine that I could include in my drawings. So I guess I'm heir to the internet, where a lot of these frogs have been documented in motion and in action. Photographs are one thing, but film, for me, is much better because I can see them articulate in ways that just a still photo won't provide. On the other hand, I wanted to do a lot more than just give an illustration like a photograph. I wanted to include the habitat. I wanted to include their interaction with it as much
as
I could.
Right.
Because Marty's narrative, which I think is extraordinary, by the way, brings you right into the moment, and that drawing should augment, complement, and maybe even include something that the narrative can't quite include, but I could. So there you go.
So you worked from film, I find that fascinating that you did that, that you worked from film, but it makes total sense. How closely do you like these kinds of assignments where you're working on assignment instead of just your own work?
I do, Mark, because, and I've had that question, because I like the challenge.
Oh, yeah.
And I have put frogs into some of my other drawings, even including a pygmy owl, a frugenous owl attacking a frog in the Southwest. So I knew a little bit about the form, and I liked it. But the challenge to do such a variety of species was very satisfying to me, and I could look back on it and say, well, I guess I was up to it as far as I could, and I'm satisfied, and that was important in the process.
Do you enjoy working on deadline?
I tell you, I do, in part because it's a driver to get things done, and I have to set aside some other projects, some of which in sculpture you mentioned, and exhibits, and integrate that, but deadlines I can integrate pretty well into the calendar, and I like that to a certain degree. And I've had a lot of them with a lot of books over the years, so I'm kind of used to it, I guess.
Talk to me about what your studio is like.
Well, you elicit a big laugh here because it's one of the standard challenges that I face. I've got, you could argue, three of them. I have two here in Lake Forest Park, one on one side facing our creek, the other one on the other side of the property. And one of the outside is for sculpture. And I don't carve stone inside. And I can model waxes or clays for bronze work inside. But they are a mess. And I tend to move from project to project, put down a tool, and then wonder, where in God's name did that go? And so, I'll get another one. Well, some of those are kind of expensive, so I dig through. But they tend to be messy. The one on Lopez Island, which is a retreat up in the Salish Sea north of us, that one is relatively neat, simply because I take work up and I bring work back. But that's a great place because it's solitude and it's remote. The ones here are semi-solitude, but and that's important to get things done too. So in brief, that's a kind of a general description. Good light and outside, no heat. And I've been out historically working in this. I'm talking 45 years ago doing a big two-ton piece of stone. For
what kind of stone? What kind of stone?
Well, it was serpentine.
Oh, nice.
Beautiful, great, huge chunk out of Wyoming for a centerpiece in the library, Capitol Library in Olympia. And we had nothing but snow. But it didn't matter then, Mark, at that age, because I'd get up there and I'd be so determined and I guess it's action-oriented that I created my own little heat system and I could do it. And by the way, incidentally, that was just about the time we had our eruptions of Mount St. Helens.
Oh, God.
So there's a long story that goes with that as how we got it installed and everything, but that's not part of our conversation. But so inside, outside studios for different purposes, all of them in need of cleanup.
I want to talk to you about your evolution as an artist. You were born in L.A., and again, God help all the people who are there.
Exactly.
I know several people who've lost their homes. How did you get from L.A. to Washington?
Well, and by the way, I certainly share that concern and empathy for the people there, because a lot of those canyons that are burning, I used to explore as a kid before I came north. But my ticket out of L.A., which I was determined to get, was through athletics. I was a football player and a track shot putter, discus thrower, and I got a dual scholarship at the University of Washington at 17, and that got me right up to where I wanted to be because I had this romantic notion of the Northwest, and it sure didn't disappoint me. It still had that accessibility that I had lost in L.A., the both population, traffic, smog, and everything else. But now look at it now, and you see the devastation. And I had no idea. No one had any idea that we would have that climate change influence and the droughts that would set up those systems for fires like they are. But in any event, I left at 17, and I am 84 years old, and I have been here 65 years. Yeah.
Were you one of those people, like myself, who as a young person was fascinated by the natural world?
Yeah.
So what you're in L.A., how are you going about to access your need for seeing cool stuff?
Sure. Well, at the time, the L.A. River had yet to go into an aqueduct.
Mm.
They had floods in the late 30s, early 40s. And they didn't start building up that cement enclosure until well into the late 40s and into the 50s. So there were still local creeks and streams and ponds.
Oh,
and
wow.
Me and my buddies would ride our bikes just up the street and down, loaded with frogs, loaded with even fish that are, I'm sure, now long extinct because of the habitat loss down there. But we had migratory waterfowl coming through along the rivers, and we'd take our bikes and ride to Griffith Park, which even had occasionally condors going overhead. Yeah, and at that time. And, you know, I remember going up to the Sespe Canyon with a buddy of mine and his parents, where the condors were nesting at the time, seeing some and enjoying that area long before it really got inundated and changed dramatically. So I had that critical accessibility that kids need so much to make those connections, boys and girls that can apply their learning and discovery and curiosity to these kinds of locations. it's essential to life, but certainly to mine. And I argue to everyone who has to understand the nature of our existence and our dependency on it.
I totally agree with you, Tony, because I was a kid. I grew up in Watertown outside of Boston, so it was a suburb. But I grew up right close to the Charles River at that point. Now, it was a very polluted river, but up above the pollution, I collected frogs, snapping turtles, and I got to see the last, before they put in the barrier at the mouth of the river, I got to see the last herring and smelt runs.
Oh, my.
Which I had never seen anything. I thought that's the way all rivers were going to be. And that there would be hundreds and hundreds of fish, and people would just throw out a line with no bait and just snag fish.
Sure.
And, of course, that doesn't happen anymore. But it definitely, those kinds of experiences form you as an adult and inform you. You get to learn stuff about how the natural world works by doing that.
You know, it's curious juxtaposition, because my dad was a private investigator in L.A. all of his life, over 45 years. He worked for Hoover as an FBI agent long before I was born, and was sent to South America, which was the equivalent of the CIA going down there to determine what was going on to ship munitions out of South America to Europe to use in V-2 rockets. And so, well, anyway, so his background from Michigan and his early life that was shared with my early life that we shared with his was far different than anything that I would, you know, experience before. But I do remember it, and I remember the kinds of clients that he had. This may sound zany, but it's absolutely true. Howard Hughes lived at our house.
Oh, no, come on.
Look, I'm totally honest about this. And so did a couple of other stars that were on the fly, but of course Hughes was reclusive and paranoid anyway.
Was this in the days of the Spruce Goose?
Oh sure, yeah, no, definitely, yeah.
I think oh my God,
been built, yeah. And my mom and I would go to Michigan, and we spent the summer there for 2.5 months while Gene Peters and Hughes lived in our house, and that was interesting because in Michigan, I got a different kind of dose of nature through the rural communities that I lived in with my aunts and uncles. And that was critical to my upbringing as well. Terrific Uncle Nat that took me out to the woods to discover all kinds of things, including the kind of froglet migrations out of ponds that we experienced during the summer that Marty describes in the book.
Oh, yeah, we have it here, too. And then we call it, the weather has to be a certain thing. It's at the end of March or beginning of April, and it's called Big Night. And it's got to be a damp or slightly rainy night. And amphibians, frogs of certain species, and then a lot of salamanders come out of they've been hibernating for the winter into their breeding ponds. And so what we do is we go out and help them get across the road. We pick them up and put them into buckets and then just walk them across where the water is.
Right.
Yeah. And it's like I feel like I'm talking to somebody who I know I can relate to the experiences.
Exactly. Yeah. So I am too, feeling the same way. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, where did you learn to surf and skin dive?
Well, that again was part of my high school experience before I left. We would hitchhike to Zuma Beach, and they had terrific, we still have terrific surf, if you can find any room with all the people down there now. But we would go down there and body surf. I did a little board surfing when I was in Hawaii at 17. I went over after I graduated from high school and before I went to University of Washington and did a little Hawaiian moment and got on a board. But most of my skills were honed body surfing at Zuma Beach and then up and down up to County Line Beach up in Ventura and all the way down the coast. Yeah.
Now, when did you start making art of the natural world?
Well, about as far back as I can remember, Mark, the time I feel was key was in the third grade, because I wasn't interested in reading. Math had no engagement for me, but I did love to draw. And Miss Denalian, a Syrian beauty, who was my third grade teacher, and I immediately fell in love with her. she's just terrific. But she basically saw the virtue in giving me a lot of room to express myself in drawing. And that then brought me to more information that I'd like to have to read. And that took me a little bit further to understand calculations and what that meant. But that particular pivot point, and again, it just reminds me how important education is to youngsters at key times. And if we keep putting everybody into one block and don't recognize the individual differences, well, we can see what kind of mire we are already in because people aren't listening and thoughtfully analyzing and thinking and considering the way we should. But apart from that, Mr. Denalian was key. I drew. I still have some of those original drawings. Did it on wrapping paper, you know, and my mom saved
Nice.
That. Yeah.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is artist Tony Angel. His paintings, drawings, bronze, and stone sculpture feature the wildlife around him. And some of the drawings that he does can be found in the new book, Frog Day, by Marty Crump. Tony, I want to talk about your work in each of the different mediums. But first, I want to talk about stone, because I'm in awe of people who work with stone. And you work with a variety of stone. Yeah. You work with a type of slate. You work with basalt. You work with limestone, serpentine. Each stone must have its own characteristic. What if you had your choice? Is it just what's available, or what material, what stone material do you favor the most?
Well, that's a complex question, and I'll kind of work my way back through it. The stone itself, regardless of what material it is, whether it's basalt or steatite, serpentine, marble, can, to me, suggest the form that I need or wish to liberate. In other words, the stone directs me. So I will often go to the rivers up here in the Cascades and have in the past and haul big, huge stones into the back of the pickup and brought them home simply because seeing them in place suggested the form of a brooding owl, a mantling eagle, maybe an otter coming up out of the water. And the form then in the stone, and it, typically up there, there is a marble up there that has been brought down through glaciation. But there's also basalt, and that is a harder stone. And yet that form that it has is remarkable because it can include different colors in it.
Yeah.
If I can incorporate the colors and the shape, that's what I'm after. So if I was to pick a single stone that I would want to work with continuously, it would probably be marble because it's something you well, not only see the form in the stone, but you can predict where it's going. It's a little less contentious, if you will. It doesn't resist as much. And, of course, historically, all the way through the Stone Age to into the Greek period, the Renaissance, and even clearly today, marble is quarried in Carrara, and that statuario is the beautiful marble of choice that we have in our cathedrals and what have you. And I've carved that.
You did a wonderful trumpeter swan.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Yeah.
You did, and I think this is the one I'm thinking of. There's a falcon that you did that has sort of a fascinating golden mustard sort of color, and I think it's made out of agilisius slate.
Oh, okay. Well,
it's not a color I usually see in stone.
An argillaceous slate. I've done falcons in that. It's typically black, and argillaceous slate is probably most famous because the native people of the Pacific Northwest, particularly the Tlingit in the Queen Charlotte Islands, carved these magnificent works in argillaceous slate. And you can imagine everything from a modest totem pole to a soup dish to a this and that and the other thing. And so I got wind of the slate through my concern and interest and admiration of their carving, and picked up some at some point or another, maybe traded with somebody in Canada. And we often trade and exchange stone as well as picking it up as we can, and even buy it from brokers. Indiana limestone I purchased over the years for monuments in front of various buildings. So it varies. And it's, again, it could be the shape. It could be the pattern in the stone, not so much that it disrupts the shape that you're trying to achieve, which can be disrupted because the stone is beautiful. You don't see what you're trying to state in the stone itself. But and working with it, a friend of mine, a great pal, I'm sorry he's gone now, Ivan Doig, a writer, a neighbor and a guy who we used to go out on field trips and everything else. He writes about the American West, D-O-I-G. Well worth Googling, by the way. Ivan and I recorded a piece for public radio that we never finished because I told him about the way stone sings.
Oh.
Okay. Think about that for a minute. A stone has a sound. A stone has a sound when you start. If you tap it, you can hear a rattle and maybe an imperfection, and there's something you have to look for. So you listen, and it's like a heartbeat. You know, yep. You're trying to fathom the depths of the stone. And then when you work your way through it, a stone, when it's finished and the rough exterior is now polished down, can ring like a bell. Believe me, a ring like a bell. A marble piece that is finished, if I tap it at a particular extended point, it has this beautiful ring to it. So we recorded these different intervals in the stone, and we never did anything about it. I think it's in his archives at the University of Montana where his work resides. But that can give you a little bit about my approach to stone. The other part that I need to mention, Mark, is the fact that the physicality of working with the stone, it's like a... It's not exactly a wrestling match. It's a dance.
Yeah.
And the stone wants to go one way, and you want to go with it. But on the other hand, you want it to come here.
So is it more of a wrestling match?
No, it's not quite. Sometimes it is. Yeah, especially if it doesn't want to get up off the ground, and I got to get it up there where I can work on it.
Oh, that's
a wrestle. Yeah.
But we're going to run out of time, Tony. And I want to talk to you. You've done bronze. You do scratchboard, you do lithograph and pencil. I notice you do a lot of raptors, and why not? I mean, anybody who's seen a peregrine or a deer falcon, you want to capture that. But you also
I used to be a falconer too.
That helps, and that also gave you knowledge of the form.
The frog, the what?
The form. I mean, when you're a falconer, you're going to know intimately the forms of what it looks like flying and perched.
Exactly, and we've got lots of them wintering here on our floodplains that we see every year. And as I say, I used to have injured birds and an injured bird permit to release them back to the wild. So I would have them, some of them, for years.
Wow.
One of them that I had for 8 years, a merlin that had been terribly wounded, shot by somebody. And she was just a valiant, beautiful bird. It's in this current Birds and Art show in Wisconsin, and It's called Indomitable because her spirit was never gone. She just always powerful presence and wasn't going to let me forget that I'm part of the race that injured her. I think that was part of it. But she'd calm down, and, you know, we had these great sessions working together. So, yeah, falcons.
But you also do a lot of alcids. You do things like murrelets and guillemots.
Yeah, we have them again.
Well, they nest where you are.
They do. There are still remaining marble murrelet nests in old-growth forests of what remnants remain. Yeah.
Here on the East Coast, people find it hard to believe that alcids nest in trees, but murrelets are there in trees on the Pacific Northwest.
And they're not the only ones. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, before we run out of time, please give out your website address.
Well, it's tonyangel.net as far as I don't go there a lot.
But you can see the examples of everything that we're talking about.
Sure. Yeah, it's there.
And that's Tony, and that's Angel with two L's at the end.
Yeah, and the gallery, Foster White Gallery in Seattle, has a real good range of historical work that I've had. And they also have some videos that I've done I did a video for the Frog Day book down there when we had the drawings up last October. And those are accessible, just Foster White, Foster/White Gallery, Seattle. And then my name comes up with others, and they have an array of things they can look at there, too.
Is there an animal or bird that you haven't covered yet that you are dying to?
Yeah, fascinating. I think, I don't know, somehow or another, the reptilian shapes intrigue me. In part, you know, they're ancestors of birds. Maybe that has something to do with it.
I know. You have a bunch of frogs under your belt. Why not do some reptiles?
I'm getting close. Yeah. Close. Yeah. I think they're marvelous. And I had lots of snakes growing up, too.
I'm with you on that. We're completely out of time. My guest tonight is artist Tony Angel. His paintings, drawings, bronze and stone sculpture feature a lot of the wildlife around him and also wildlife from around the world. Some of his drawings can be found in the book Frog Day by Marty Crump. Hey, Tony, it's been a real pleasure.
Likewise, Mark. Terrific.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.